All right, so this is Bio 231, and it's Monday, September 21st, and we're going to move into the appendicular skeleton. All right, so we've looked at the axial skeleton. So refresh my memory, what the heck is the axial skeleton? What bones make up the axial skeleton? Skull, I like that. The vertebral column, and somebody said the rib cage. Or thoracic cage. Yeah, that's a really good idea. All right, so you got all those vertebrae, including the sacrum and the coccyx. You got the ribs and you got the sternum. And remember, there's three pieces to the sternum, or the three bones you should know. And then all the bones that make up the cranium as well as facial bones. So that's the axial skeleton. Appendicular skeleton are bones of the upper limb and lower limb. And some other bones, too, that help attach the limbs to your axial skeleton. The bones that help attach your upper limbs to your axial skeleton are what we call the pectoral girdle. And what does it mean to girdle something? Sometimes it helps to know. It means to surround, right? Completely surround something. And there are two bones on one side of your body that surround your rib cage, superior rib cage, and that is the scapula and clavicle, which we see here and here. The clavicle is kind of like an S-shaped bone. That's the anterior bone. But the part of the girdle that forms the posterior part is what we call the scapula. So these are actually part of the appendicular skeleton, but more importantly, they're part of the pectoral girdle because they attach your upper appendage to your axial skeleton. And here we see part of the axial skeleton, namely the body of the sternum. And what part of the sternum is this right here by the arrow? That's the manubrium. As a matter of fact, this is the only joint, the manubrioclavicular joint, that attaches your upper appendage to your axial skeleton, just that little joint right there. All right. The rest of the strength of holding that appendage to your body are due to muscles that attach your thorax to the scapula. So there are a lot of muscles. Your scapula is highly mobile, and that's what allows you a lot of dexterity and motion of your upper appendage, because the scapula is not fixed in position, right? It can move. It can elevate. It can depress. It can rotate. All kinds of different motions depending on the activity of various muscles that attach to it. Okay, so the things that you got to know about the clavicle right here, that there are basically two ends. There's one end that attaches to the acromion process of the scapula. So we call this the acromial end. And then the other end attaches to the manubrium, so we call this the sternal end. The sternal end is very big, bony prominence. It's very massive compared to the acromial end. So be sure in lab to take a look, because you can't really get a good feel for this just in lecture. But the acromial end is flat. It's like a knife blade. So if you look at it on edge, it looks really flat. But if you look at it from the top or bottom, it kind of looks flat. All right. But the sternal end, no matter which way you look at it, from an anterior view or superior view or inferior view, it's massive. So it's kind of round, right? It's not flat at all. It's more like shaped like the opening of a trumpet or a clarinet or something. So it's pretty easy not to mix those two ends up. And then here's a conoid tubercle on the clavicle, which helps with the ligaments that stabilize the shoulder joint. Okay, next bone would be the scapula. And again, in lab, when you start to work with these things, pick the bone up and actually model it on yourself. And I suppose even during the practicum, if you're interested to do that, you can go ahead and pick the bones up. But be really careful that you don't take any of the markers off the tape off of them. All right, so there is an anterior side and a posterior side. The anterior side is the deep side. Right, and the posterior side is the part that's sticking out of your back. That's the side that you can palpate, and you can palpate this scapular spine very easily, and you can feel the muscles on either side of the scapular spine. The fossa underneath the spine is called the infraspinous fossa, and the fossa above the spine is the supraspinous fossa, and that has the corresponding muscles inside there. In the subscapular fossa, that's the deep one, so we say subscapular because it's what? Deep to the scapula, underneath the scapula. So subscapular fossa holding the subscapularis muscle. And then hopefully you could recognize that this is the lateral border pretty easily because here is the glenoid cavity, which is going to articulate with the head of the humerus. And of course that is going to be poking out laterally. And then on the opposite side is going to be the medial border. So you see the lateral border, medial border, and superior border. So that means that this is the inferior point on the scapula. We call that the inferior angle as opposed to the superior angle up over here. All right, some other things that you should know besides the spine. The spine proceeds laterally and it ends with this big bony prominence right here, which is the acromion process. And the other bony prominence is the coracoid process. Kind of looks like a beak of a bird sticking out right there. So acromion and coracoid process. And the only other thing, oh, there's actually three things left. And I don't know if I have a picture of it. I think you have a picture of it in your book. Okay, there is a tubercle underneath or inferior to the glenoid cavity right here. All right, and the tubercle is a process. So what's the function of this tubercle that's underneath the glenoid cavity? Muscle attachment. And it is called the infraglenoid tubercle, right? Because it's below the glenoid fossa. And there's also a tubercle above the glenoid cavity. And it's called the supraglenoid tubercle. So you got supraglenoid tubercle and infraglenoid tubercle. Those are both for muscle attachments. The supra is for attachment of a biceps, and the infraglenoid tubercle is due to attachment of a triceps on the other side of the arm. We'll start looking at that maybe in a couple weeks. Okay, so the two tubercles, and then the suprascapular notch in the superior border of the scapula. So that's pretty much it for the scapula. Has a lot of muscles attached to it. It's highly mobile, and that's what gives your upper appendage a lot of range of motion, a lot of freedom of motion. Okay, the other thing that gives your upper appendage a lot of range of motion is that the glenoid cavity is not very deep. It's very, very shallow. So that means that you have a lot of mobility with the humerus, but that comes with a price. And what's the price associated with a high degree of mobility of the shoulder? Okay, it's not very strong, right? It can be easily damaged as a result of that. Okay. Okay, so here, this is a pretty nice illustration because it shows the different depressions of the scapula. So on the anterior side, you can see the nice subscapular fossa. On the posterior side, you can see the supraspinous fossa and the infraspinous fossa. Okay, and this would be looking at what edge, the lateral border or the medial border? That's lateral because there's a glenoid cavity right there. Okay, so attached to the scapula is the single bone in the arm, and that's the humerus. And associated or articulating with the glenoid cavity is the head of the humerus, which is right here. That's a nice smooth condyloid surface of the humerus, but we call it the head, even though it kind of looks like a condyle, and indeed it is a smooth condylar surface, but that's the head. And then there's a little narrowing right through here. That's the anatomical neck. It's still very, very strong, so it's rare that that part of the humerus fractures. It's more common to have a distal fracture in this region right here, so this is what we call the surgical neck, right, because this is where fractures typically take place. All right, in between the anatomic neck and surgical neck, there are some other features that you should be aware of on the anterior side of the humerus. These bony processes right here that are very rough, these are called tubercles. One is a big one, one's a small one, so here's the greater tubercle and the lesser tubercle, a little bit more medial, and in between them is a sulcus or a depression. It's a long sulcus, sometimes it's called a groove, and this is what we call the intertubercular groove because it goes right between the tubercles. And again, it's a part of the biceps. There's a tendon that runs right through here and then attaches to the supraglenoid tubercle, which I mentioned in one of the previous slides. All right, mid-diaphysis, there is a process, and guess what muscle attaches to that process? The deltoid, which is the muscle of the shoulder. Okay, and that's important for when we get to joints in the next chapter. We'll see what the action of that deltoid is. Right, but it attaches right here, moves the humerus around. All right, on the distal epiphysis, there is a condylar surface, right, which is kind of similar in function to the head. Right, so here's the head of the humerus, but if we go to the distal epiphysis, we can see some smooth articulating surfaces. These are condyles as well, but they're so special that they're given special names. So this one is very spherical. This is called the capitulum. And the one right next to it, which kind of looks like a spool or a bobbin that you could wind some thread up on, right? This is what's called the trochlea. And you should know which one is medial and lateral because you might be asked what bone articulates with these condylar surfaces. So if you look at the capitulum right here, is that the medial or lateral condylar surface of the distal humerus? It's lateral, and a good way to tell is, well, look at the head of the humerus, which is always going to be pointing medially because that's attaching to the scapula medially. So the capitulum is lateral. All right, so a good question would be, what bone articulates with the capitulum? And the answer you would work through in your mind is, well, gee whiz, what's the lateral bone in the forearm, right? And that is the radius. So the head of the radius articulates with the capitulum. And then the other bone in your forearm is the ulna. That's what articulates with the trochlea right here. All right, so somehow, you know, if you got to draw it out or whatever, but, you know, you should be able to kind of reason that out within maybe 30 seconds if you don't have it on the tip of your tongue. That's probably a good one to have on the tip of your tongue, okay? So head of the radius articulates with the capitulum, and the ulna articulates with the trochlea, and in particular, you should know what part of the ulna articulates with the trochlea. And with a little bit of studying, that's not too hard to remember because it's given basically the same name. It would be the trochlear notch articulates with the trochlea, right? And the trochlear notch is on the ulna. Okay. So this is an anterior view. The posterior view, okay, I don't see much in the way of condylar surfaces. I see a little bit of the trochlea. But what is remarkable is this big depression in the posterior part of the humerus. This is what we call the olecranon fossa, because there is a massive bony process on the ulna, and that's called the olecranon process that has to fit into this depression when the elbow is extended. Okay, when the humerus and the forearm, or the arm and the forearm, form a straight line, that process has to fit into this depression right here. So the olecranon process has to fit into the olecranon fossa. And the olecranon process is what? This point of your elbow right here that's sticking out that we unfortunately bang all the time. Right? That's the olecranon process. And on the anterior side, we see a couple other fossa. The coronoid fossa is there. That accepts the coronoid process of the ulna when your forearm is flexed. There has to be a place to accept the coronoid process, and the radial fossa right here has to accept the head of the radius when your forearm is flexed. All right, so that's everything on the humerus. What did I miss? Oh, some epicondyles. All right, so we said the capitulum and the trochlea are the condylar surfaces for articulation. Superior to these condylar surfaces are these processes that we call the epicondyles. That means what? Epi means above or on top of the condyles. And these are important for muscle attachment as well. So here is the medial epicondyle. And how would you know this is medial epicondyle? One way is because you would say, oh, well, the trochlea is medial. The capitulum is lateral. Or you could say what? Ah, the head is medial. So therefore, this has got to be the medial side of the humerus. And then here is a lateral epicondyle right here. All right, so how is this going to make sense? We got to make sense of it when we look at the ulna and radius. So here is the radius, which is lateral, and the ulna medial. We see a nice interosseous membrane between them, and that forms a fibrous joint, but that's a pretty loose fibrous joint. There's a lot of motion between the ulna and radius. Just stabilizes it just ever so slightly. All right, so here is the head of the radius, and then this narrowing is the neck. And what part of the humerus does the head of the radius articulate with? It is the capitulum, the capitulum. That's the lateral side. All right, and then there is a bony prominence right here. That's the radial tuberosity. That's for muscle attachment. All right, so let's move over to the ulna. And let's see if I can get maybe a little bit better aspect of the ulna. Ah, this is a good place to look at the ulna right here. All right, so here's the ulna. And this is forming the point of your elbow, if you look at just surface anatomy. And that's what we call the olecranon process. Guess what the function of the olecranon process is? That's a muscle attachment. And in particular, that's going to be the insertion of the triceps muscle, which is a big, strong muscle in your posterior arm, attaches right there. Okay? And when your arm is straight at the elbow, this thing has to find a place to go into the humerus. Right? And what did we call that? That spot. I don't think I have it here. That spot is right here. Okay, so this would be the olecranon fossa. So the olecranon process has to fit right into this fossa right here when your elbow is straight. Okay, now when your elbow is flexed, all right, there's another part of the ulna that has to fit into the coronoid fossa. And that process is called the coronoid process. All right, so let's go look at that. So here is the coronoid process. So when your forearm is flexed, that has to fit right into the coronoid fossa. So here is the coronoid process. And then the olecranon process is where? Back over here, which we can't see in this particular view. And then here is the head of the ulna. When your arm is flexed, the head of the ulna fits into the radial fossa right here. Right, so it doesn't form contusions on the bones. You got the capitulum and trochlea. All right, so sliding around the trochlea is going to be the trochlear notch. So here's the trochlear notch in the ulna. All right, so I think we kind of noticed this nomenclature before when we looked at the zygomatic arch. Right, the zygomatic arch is made up partly of the temporal bone and partly of the zygomatic bone. Right, so the temporal bone is back over here, and there's a process that sticks anteriorly, and it touches the zygomatic bone. So what can you tell me about, how would we name that process of the temporal bone? Because we name it by the bone that it touches, which is the zygomatic bone, right? So we name these fossa pretty much the same way, because what fits in this fossa right here? We wouldn't call this the humeral fossa. We call this the coronoid fossa because the coronoid process is something that associates with it, right? And this is the radial fossa because the head of the radius associates with it. And then on the posterior humerus, right, that's the olecranon fossa because the olecranon process fits into it when the arm is straight. All right, so that same bit of nomenclature. All right, and that's even more important when we look at the joint between the head of the radius and the ulna, right? Because right in here is a very important joint that allows your hand to either pronate or supinate. Right, so your palms can face anteriorly or they can face posteriorly, depending on whether you're pronated or supinated. And so the radius has to turn up against the ulna right here. And so here is a nice notch that the head of the radius fits in, right? That's on the ulna, so we can't call that the ulnar notch. What bone is seated in this notch right here? It's the radius, so therefore we call this the radial notch of the ulna. All right, so that's pretty easy to see. And then if we go, so that's at the proximal end of the forearm, but if we go to the distal end of the forearm, there's another radial ulnar joint. All right, so this is the lateral bone, namely the radius. And then here is the ulna. And this right here is the head of the ulna, and it fits in a notch in the radius. So would we want to call this the radial notch or the ulnar notch? That's the ulnar notch because it's the ulna that fits in there on the distal epiphysis of the radius. All right, so what's one other thing that's a little strange? Well, the head of the radius is what, proximal or distal? The head of the radius. And, of course, always think of anatomic position. It's proximal, right? The head of the radius is proximal. But what about the head of the ulna? Where is that? It's distal. All right, so it flips position. So just kind of be aware of that. So way down over here, you've got a notch in the radius to accept the head of the ulna, and we would call that the ulnar notch. And then up over here, in the proximal part of the ulna, there is a notch that accepts the head of the radius, and we would call that the radial notch. Right? So that shouldn't be too bad. But I suppose you could confuse that around. Okay. All right, there's a couple little pointy processes on the distal epiphyses of both the radius and the ulna, and these are sharp, narrow points, and they're therefore muscle attachment, and these sharp, narrow processes typically are called styloid processes. So here you see the styloid process of the ulna, and here's the styloid process of the radius. All right, so styloid process is pretty good to remember there. Okay, so don't forget capitulum and trochlea and how that forms the elbow joint. All right, so that takes us to hands. Okay, a lot of bones in the hands. You don't have to know all the bones. You got to know generally what they're called, and in particular the wrist bones. So the bones of the wrist are what we call carpals. And there are eight of them, and they all have their own little names. But I'm not going to test you on the names of the carpals. I don't know if anybody feels really bad about that, but hopefully not. Okay. But there is one bone that is really interesting, and that one is in the most proximal row. So it's the top row as opposed to the bottom row down over here. And this one is seated right in the condylar fossa of the radius, right? And look how big the radius is. It's really big and massive and strong. And this first bone right here is called the scaphoid. And look how kind of small it is, and it has these small processes sticking off of it, okay? Which means that the scaphoid, because of where it's situated, but the structure of the scaphoid, since it's so small and it has these narrow processes, it's easy to break. So the scaphoid is by far the most common of all the carpals to break when somebody falls, because when you fall, what do? You reach behind you and cut yourself, right? And you kind of catch yourself with the butt of your thumb right here, the palm of your hand. And is that medial or lateral, your thumb? It's lateral, so what bone does it line up with? It's the radius, and look how big and massive the radius is. So the radius has a tendency just to crush that scaphoid right there. All right, so that's a very common injury. Unfortunately, when that happens, the blood supply to the scaphoid is interrupted, and it doesn't like to grow back. All right, so what do you think that means to the health of that scaphoid right there? Okay. Now, what can you tell me about bone? Is it like that concrete pillar that we have in the corner of the room, or this concrete wall right here? Bone is living tissue, right? There are osteocytes in there and osteoblasts, and in order for them to stay alive, they need oxygen and nutrients, and if there's no blood supply going in there, they're not getting oxygen, they're not getting nutrients, so those cells are going to die. And when they die, the scaphoid then just necroses and it dissolves away, and that just produces a nasty motion deficit in the wrist as a result of that. And I really haven't heard of any techniques to help preserve that scaphoid after it fractures. Okay, that's just an unfortunate complication. Okay. All right, so all of these bones of the wrist, there's one you have to know specifically by name, that's the scaphoid, but all the rest as a group, you should know them as carpals, right? So all of the bones of the wrist are carpals. Okay, so your hand, I'm speaking very generally, your hand can be thought up as being made of three different kinds of bones. There's bones of the wrist, there's bones of the hand proper, right? And then there's bones that make the fingers right here. So try to classify the bones up to, into those three categories. So wrists are what we call made out of carpals, and bones of the hand proper are made out of metacarpals. Okay, now you should know how to talk about these bones. There's only five of them, and the nomenclature is very easy. They're just called metacarpals, but they're also given numbers. And you start counting 1 through 5, starting with the thumb. So the thumb would be the number 1 metacarpal, and then on your little finger right over here, most lateral one, that would be the number 5 metacarpal. All right. For some reason, that's really easy to mix up on a practicum. I don't know why that is. But it's just like, you could like use your hands, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, okay? So make sure, even though it seems really easy, practice it or think of it or something so that you don't miss it on the practicum, okay? Okay, so you always start counting number one with what? When you're like hitchhiking or something, yeah, number one. Okay, here are a couple little bones that are situated in a tendon of the thumb. So they're completely surrounded by tendon, and a bone that's completely surrounded by tendon is called a sesamoid bone. So here's a sesamoid bone right here and right here. All right, and that's a normal for these bones to be there all the time. Just like your kneecap is a sesamoid bone, your patella is a sesamoid, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. Okay. All right, so then your fingers, what's the proper anatomical designation for a finger? Well, it's really, okay, I heard phalanges, I heard finger, but you know what? The proper term, somebody just said digit. Okay, so a digit and a finger are really the same kind of thing. And digit is more proper. And so here I see, what digit number is this right here? That's number one. And here's digit number 2, and digit 3, 4, and 5. And digits have more than one bone in them. And all of these bones that make up the digits are called phalanges. All right, but a digit the single form of phalanges is plural, the singular form is called phalanx. All right, but a phalanx and a digit are not really the same thing. Because here I see a digit, this is your thumb, and there are two phalanges that make it up. So a number of phalanges come together to make a digit. So you got to be a little bit more precise in describing it. In digit number one, or the thumb, there are only two phalanges. There is this one and this one down over here. All right, so the top one is what we call the proximal, and the one that's farther away from some center attachment point to your body is called the distal, and this would be the distal number 1 phalanx, and here is the proximal number 1 phalanx. So the thumb has two phalanges in it, which kind of separates it from the rest of the digits, because look at digit number 2 over here. All right, so here is number 2 metacarpal, so here is number 2 phalanx, and this is the proximal one. And then look down over here. Here's the distal one, but you see there's one in between. So we call that the middle phalanx. So this is the middle number 2 phalanx. And I suppose if you want to be really careful, you could say what hand it's on or something. That's probably pretty good if you're actually dealing with a real human and not just a picture. Obviously, you want to know right from left as well. Okay, it's not real important on the practicum. All right, so the rest of the digits have three phalanges. So I tell you what, tell me what this one is right here, where the cursor is. Okay, What number is it? That's number four. And then distal? Yeah, phalanx. Number four, distal phalanx. That would completely describe that bone right there. All right, what about this one right here? That's number five, middle phalanx. And that you wouldn't get that mixed up with any other bone in your body, you know, of course, if you could say right or left. All right, so that's what you have to know about the hand. And in lab, hands and feet kind of look similar because they all have digits, right? But make sure you look at the difference, at least in your book, between hands and feet. What would be one way that you could tell a foot from a hand? The bones of the ankle are more massive, right, than the bones of the wrist, right? So when we look at tarsals, there are two bones that you actually have to know. One is making up your heel, that's the calcaneus, is really huge. And then we're also going to look at the talus, right? So that would be a nice dead giveaway. The foot is also a little bit longer as a result of that, right? So, okay. So what about this upper appendage? What do you want to go over with this upper appendage? Anything at all? You know, you got to pay pretty close attention to this elbow joint right here because of all the little processes and notches and things in it. All right, so don't forget the head of the radius is proximal, but the head of the ulna is distal, right? But yet they still fit together, so there's a nice ulnar notch in the radius and there's a nice radial notch in the ulna right here so that you can pronate and supinate this kind of motion, right? And when we get to articulations in the next chapter, we'll start defining what some of these different motions are called anatomically. It's actually hard to talk about motions without knowing the proper terms for them. Okay, what about the, what attaches? What attaches this humerus right here to your axial skeleton? What helps do that? Or I could ask you, what bones attach the humerus to your axial skeleton? The clavicle and scapula. Perfect. And together, what do we consider the clavicle and scapula? That's the pectoral girdle. Pectoral girdle. Okay? Pectoral girdle. Because remember on that one diagram for the first test, that was your pectoral region, right? Your anterior upper thoracic cavity, pectoral region. Okay, so that's kind of it for the upper appendage. All right, let's move on to the lower appendage or lower limb. Okay. So there is something that attaches your lower limb to your axial skeleton, and that's what we call the pelvic girdle. It's the pelvic girdle, okay? And again, a girdle means to surround, and it's surrounding what? Your pelvic cavity. So it's called the pelvic girdle as a result. The pelvic girdle, all right, is made up basically of one bone on either side, and that's called the os coxae or coxal bone. I don't care what you call it. Yeah.
Either
one. That's right. You know, as a matter of fact, you know, if it's a multiple choice question, I guess you got to know that coxal bone and os coxae are the same. On a practicum, if you put an answer down, and if I take off for it, if you find it in a book, any reputable reference, then of course I'll give you credit for it, right? So, unfortunately, things might have four or five different names, and you just show me the proper reference for it, and I'll give you credit if I'm not familiar with it, okay? Usually I'm pretty familiar with some of this stuff, but there might be something I haven't heard of before. Okay. And an os coxae is actually a fusion of three bones that fuse during development, right? The most superior one is the ilium, and the most anterior is the pubic bone, and the most inferior is called the ischium. So these three bones fuse together, and if you were to look at a real os coxae, you can see the lines of fusion most notably within the acetabulum, right? You can maybe find them on more of a medial aspect of an os coxae, but there's so many muscles that attach there. It's such a rough surface, you probably wouldn't see anything. But what can you tell me about the surface of the acetabulum? Should it be rough and jagged? No, it should be nice and smooth because it's an articular surface, right? So any lines of fusion would be most obviously seen in that particular region. Okay, so the acetabulum is made out of partly the ilium, partly the ischium, and partly the pubis. It all joined right here. And the acetabulum is what? A fossa that is going to articulate with the head of the femur. So what is the acetabulum like on the scapula? What is it? Its function is the glenoid cavity. Yeah. Okay, but one thing that you might notice already, the glenoid cavity was very shallow. Well, how can you describe the depth of the acetabulum? See acetabulum right here? It's very, very deep, right? So the hip joint is very strong. It's a very secure joint, but the trade-off is you don't have a lot of range of motion with it, not compared to the shoulder, right? So one thing gives away to an advantage in another aspect. All right, so here is the sacrum and the coccyx. But don't forget, the sacrum and the coccyx is not really part of the appendicular skeleton. It's really part of the vertebral column, so that makes it part of the axial skeleton. It's just drawn in this figure, just so that you could see this structure right here. And typically, when we have tuas coxae articulated with the sacrum and the coccyx right here, we call that a pelvis. Right, so not a pelvic bone, but a pelvis. And you can see a lot of interesting things about a pelvis, but you may have noticed, or maybe not have noticed, there's a big difference between a male and female pelvis. And I think I showed you that in lab, right? And it really has to do with the size of the birth canal, right? By looking at the width of the pelvic outlet or pelvic inlet as defined from one ischial spine to the other. The female, of course, it's got to be a greater distance, right? The pubic arch, so this kind of looks like a male to me, okay, because this pubic arch is a little bit less than 90 degrees. If it was a female, it would be greater than 90 degrees, right? This also kind of looks heart-shaped to me. The pelvic inlet looks heart-shaped. And that would also be another indication that this is a male pelvis. All right. All right, so the disarticulated os coxae. This can be challenging, okay? But how do you get situated? Well, think of what bone is the superior part of the os coxae. That's the ilium. And then think, what's the inferior part? That's going to be, that's what we're sitting on, that's the ischium. And then the anterior part is going to be the pubic bone. And then one last thing to help you get oriented, a good lateral landmark would be the acetabulum, right, that's going to articulate with the head of the femur. All right, so anterior is what we said, pubic bone. So this is the anterior side of an os coxae. That means that this is the posterior side, right? And we're looking at the acetabulum, so this is lateral, and of course this is superior and inferior. All right, so we got a bunch of bumps on this bone. Oh, what's nicely color-coded on this illustration right here is that the ilium, right, you can see in yellow, yeah? Okay, and the ischium is purple, thank you, and the pubic is red. Very good. That won't be a question on the test. Okay, so here we see the anterior side, right, posterior side. So this bump right here, that's a process for muscle attachment. It's anterior, right, because here's that pubic bone, and it's also way up on top, so it's anterior superior. It's part of the ilium, and we call it a spine, so anterior superior iliac spine. And then down below it is the anterior inferior iliac spine. And then on the posterior side, you've got two corresponding processes. Here is the posterior superior iliac spine, posterior inferior iliac spine. And that leads you right to this big notch in the ilium. And that's called the greater sciatic notch. All right, we see something that looks very similar to this greater sciatic notch, which is inferior to it, but it is much smaller. We call that the lesser sciatic notch. And what I wanted to point out, actually, is this process between the greater and lesser sciatic notches, right? And this, what bone is this spine on? Is it on the ilium? Are you going to get it confused with the posterior superior iliac spine or the posterior inferior iliac spine or these other two spines that are anterior. This one right here is really part of the ischium, right? So therefore we just call it the ischial spine, okay? Ischial spine between the sciatic notches. And then there's a rough raised area right here that we call the ischial tuberosity. What's the function of this ischial tuberosity? Muscle attachment. Very powerful muscles in your posterior thigh that attach there. And so it's got to be very, very strong bone. This hole, we just call that the obturator foramen. Okay, the pubic bone. Let's see, what do you have to know about the pubic bone? it's anterior. It forms the pubic symphysis, which is the joint between the ascoxae. Right, so here's the articular surface. And there's a little tubercle right here and a crest. These are all for muscle attachments. And this bridge between the body of the pubis and the body of the ilium, this is what we call the ramus of the pubis. Right, so here's the body, and it makes a 90-degree turn. That's a ramus. What else can we say about the... Oh, yes, one last thing. Just like this is an articular surface between the two pubic bones, there is an articulation between an ilium and the sacrum. All right, so here is the articular surface of the ilium that articulates with the sacrum. But sometimes we call that the auricular surface, and not articular. But you know what? I'd probably take either one of those on the practicum. Okay, but more classically spoken, it's spoken of as an auricular surface. And that should be smoother than all of this surface on the ala. So this fan of the ilium is what we call the ala. And on the inside, right, the medial side of the ala, this is what's helping form the pelvic cavity. So this is a depression that's holding pelvic organs. So we call that the iliac fossa. But on this picture, it's hard to tell that there's a depression. It has a little bit of a bowl shape to it. Okay. So that's pretty much it for the ascoxae. So what's another way to think of the ascoxae? What does it help make in your body? There are two different ways you could think about it. It makes the pelvis, indeed, right? You put a couple ascoxae together with a sacrum, that makes a pelvis. Okay. And tell me another significance of an ascoxae. What is it doing? It's attaching what to what? It's attaching your lower limb to your axial skeleton. So we say what? It helps make up the pelvic girdle. All right. So it makes the pelvic girdle. And if you put all these bones together, it also makes a pelvis up. Okay? Okay. All right, so where did that take us to? The bone of the it's called the femur, but what body region is that? That is your, I heard leg, more properly it is what, thigh? Between your hip and your knee, that's your thigh. That's not really your leg. You might think it's your leg, and that might be okay with me, except if we're in anatomy class and you got to call that your thigh. Because where's your leg? Where's your leg? It's below the knee until you get to your ankle. So between your ankle and your knee is your leg. Sounds a little strange, but that's just the proper terminology. All right, so the bone of the thigh is the femur, which we see right here. And we're also going to look at another sesamoid bone, but this one is really large. That is your kneecap. We call that the patella. Right, and it's going to completely be surrounded by a tendon, dense regular connective tissue. The patella is pretty much triangular shape. This tip right here, this pointy end, is called the apex. The anterior surface is very, very rough because there are tendons and a ligament that attach right there. But the posterior surface is going to be very, very smooth because it's an articular surface. It's going to be rubbing up against condyles of the femur, which we're going to look at really, really soon. All right, so your femur kind of looks like your humerus, except it's even bigger. The femur is the largest bone in your body. And the proximal epiphysis is what we call the head. It's a nice smooth condylar surface, normally covered with hyaline cartilage. And then there's a narrowing distal to the head. We just call that the neck. And it can fracture in that area. So there is no surgical neck or anatomic neck on the femur. It's just one and the same in this region. In the head, there is going to be a pit or a hole, and that's called the fovea capitis. And if you look inside that hole, you'll see that it's very, very rough and jagged in there because it's a site for an attachment of a ligament that goes from the femur into the ascoxae. And in particular, what part of the ascoxae? What part of the ascoxae associates with the head of the femur? That's going to be the acetabulum, right? So there's a very strong ligament that attaches the acetabulum to the femur via the fovea capitis. That's why that hole is there. And in that ligament, there is a blood vessel, right? Because this femur, does this femur need blood supply? Absolutely, right? It's living tissue. There's osteocytes in there. And if there's damage to the hip, right, that can, and it damages that ligament, ligamentum teres. I don't think you have to know the name of that ligament right now. But if you damage that blood vessel, then the cells at this of the head of the femur actually die. They necrose. And so they no longer can maintain the femur. And guess what happens to it? It necroses, and then it dissolves away. And it just leaves a nice jagged edge right here, which is going to grind away at the acetabulum. So you can't really live like that. And how would you rectify? How would you remedy that situation? With a hip replacement, right? Okay. And that happened, did I tell you in lab what who that happened to? Is a very famous athlete. He's phenomenal. He played professional baseball as well as professional football. Yeah, it was Bo Jackson. And he had his hip hurt playing football, and the head of his femur necrosed, and they replaced it. But he was such a fantastic athlete that he even went back and played baseball, even with a prosthetic hip. So that's pretty amazing. I don't think he ever wanted to play football again, though, which is a good thing. Okay. There are some things that are similar to the tubercles on the humerus that are muscle attachment sites on the femur, but they're even bigger and more massive because even bigger, stronger muscles attach to them, and these are called trochanters. The superior one and bigger one is the greater trochanter, and the smaller one is what we call the lesser trochanter, and again, the function is just muscle attachment. All right, and so here is the anterior side of the femur. On the posterior side, we see a very small, narrow, raised area, and it's really rough. Guess what this is for? Muscle attachment. That's right, muscle attachment. Because it's rough, it's a process. Even though, I mean, it's long, it's big because it's long, but it's not very tall. It's not tall like a trochanter right here. But that would be for muscle attachment as well. All right, you don't have to know these other little deviations, like these little tuberosities here. All right, and these condylar lines. But I do want you to know the linea aspera right here. Okay, which takes us to the distal part of the femur. So these surfaces are condyles, condylar surfaces. So what would they be like if you were to touch them, to palpate them with your fingertips? They would be smooth, right? They're an articulating surface covered with hyaline cartilage. And one is medial and one is lateral. So what about the one where I have the cursor? What's that? And how would you know? Just look at the head. Yeah, just look at the head of the femur. It's really easy to tell. So here is the medial condyle. Here's a lateral condyle. And there are some bony ridges above the condyles. Those are what we call epicondyles, right? So here's a lateral epicondyle, medial epicondyle. And these are sites for muscle attachment. Okay, muscle attachment. The other interesting thing we notice that there's a big notch between the condyles, all right, and we call that the intercondylar fossa or intercondylar notch. There are some really important ligaments of the knee that attach right here. Right? I don't know if anybody knows much about their knee or if they had their knee rebuilt, but there are a couple real important ligaments right in the center that form an X. Okay? And those are called the cruciate ligaments because they form what? Kind of like a cross right in there. And this is where they attach on the femur, and we're going to see where they attach to the tibia in just a little bit. So those would be the cruciate ligaments. Yeah. Anterior and posterior cruciate ligaments. Right. And then this is the patellar surface because it articulates with the patella right here. And you can see the condylar surface of the patella right here. All right, so that's femur. Anything else I want to say about femur? I think that's enough. Okay. All right, so that takes us to what part of the body? Okay, but what region is that? That's your leg. Yeah, but you're right, that's the tibia and fibula. All right, so here you got to figure out which bone is medial and which one is lateral, just like the two bones in the forearm. And you can kind of maybe tell if you just palpate your leg. Right? If you palpate your leg, I can feel a big, massive bone, and it's going to be medial. Which one is the biggest and most massive that you see right there? That's the tibia, right? So the tibia is medial, and the fibula is lateral. And there's so many muscles around the fibula that you can't really palpate it. Okay, so let's look at the proximal end of the tibia. Notice it kind of looks like a tabletop. It's very, very flat. There's a couple little depressions right here and right here. These are the articular surfaces for the condyles of the femur. And again, they're going to be nice and smooth, and they're going to be covered with hyaline cartilage. And this one right here, right, because the tibia is the medial bone in the leg, so this would be the medial condyle of the tibia. And I think this is probably the only joint in the body where there are two bones that come together to form a joint, and both ends of that bone are called condyles. Okay, so the condyles are on the femur, but condyles are also on the tibia, and they associate with each other. They're separated by some stuff that we're going to look at when we get into the joint chapter in the next chapter, but these are both condyles. But notice what's in between the medial and lateral condyles of the tibia. You've got this bump right here, which is that's called the intercondylar eminence. It's poking up. And it's a very rough surface, so that means it's not for articulation. That means something is grabbing right there. Namely, those two ligaments from the intercondylar notch, right, the cruciate ligaments attached to the tibia right in that location, both the anterior and posterior cruciate ligaments. So it's a process, and we said 99% of the time the function of a process is for muscle attachment. But here's an exception to that rule. It's kind of similar. It's not really a tendon for a muscle attachment, but it's a ligament. It's for, a bone-to-bone connection. All right, so it's a similar kind of thing. Also similar in the leg compared to the forearm, there's an interosseous membrane, which is a very flexible fibrous joint between the fibula and tibia. All right, and on the anterior side of the tibia and the proximal part of the tibia, there is a nice rough raised area right here. That's a process. Right? We call that the tibial tuberosity. So just for fun, tell me what the function of the tibial tuberosity is. Muscle attachment. Okay, big strong muscles of the anterior thigh attach right there after they go across and through the patella, and they attach right here. And we'll see what kind of motion they produce pretty soon. All right, now commonly we call this your shin bone, right, the shin, and this is the anterior border. Sometimes we call it the anterior crest of the tibia, and it's long and narrow. It's easy to contuse because it's very, very sharp right there, and that forms your shin bone. Okay. Now down by your ankle, you have a couple bony prominences that stick out laterally that form your ankle. And I used to think that your ankle, because the way you could move your ankle, there is a bone that your foot actually rotated around, like an axle on a car sticking right through here, because you had this big bony bump on one side and another bony bump on the other. But that's not how it works at all, right? These things are just called malleoli. One is a malleolus, right? And they, if you put a tibia and fibula together, it forms a notch right here, which is the ankle joint between the bones of your leg. So we're going to see what fits in right here. There's an ankle bone that fits right in here between the lateral malleolus and medial malleolus. All right, so how are you going to remember that this is the lateral malleolus right over here? Because what bone makes, what's the lateral bone in your leg?
The fibula,
yeah. And the medial bone is your tibia, right? So here is the medial malleolus. Hopefully nobody's ever cracked these off if you ever sprained your ankle really, really bad. All right, and then this is the articular surface, and there's an articular surface on the fibula as well. All right, so this joint is not nearly so complicated as, or these bones are not nearly so complicated as bones of the upper limb, okay, because your upper limb just has more dexterity, right? You can supinate or pronate your hand, but you can't really do that with your ankle. It's designed more for strength rather than mobility. Okay, so that's the trade-off. So that takes us to your hand. It's a foot. Very good. You caught me. Okay. Okay, no. I was just checking to see if anybody was awake still. Okay. So bones of the wrist are called carpals, all right? But bones of the ankle aren't called carpals. They're called tarsals. And again, I'm not going to ask you to know all the different names of the tarsals in the different rows, but I do want you to know two of them because they're pretty important. There's one that fits in right between the lateral and medial malleolus, so it's the most superior tarsal, and that one is the talus. Okay, you want to say talus, I think that's fine. That would be this one right here. Right. So here's the talus. And let's see if I can get another projection. Ah, here's the talus right here. This is the most superior one that fits in that notch between the malleoli. That's really nice. The other one that I want you to know is the big massive bone that forms your heel. And that's the calcaneus, right? So you got to know those two tarsals. And then the rest of the bones of the foot follow very nicely from what you know about the hand. So the bones of the foot proper are what we call metatarsals, because they're named after the bones that make up the ankle, right, which are tarsals. So these are metatarsals. And they're named, or they're numbered, with the same kind of nomenclature as in the hand. So the one that's associated with the great toe, which is your great toe, your big toe, okay, that's number one. And then your little toe is the fifth metatarsal, and you could just count. So I tell you what, which one is this right here that I have the cursor on? Tell me something about this bone. It's number three. Number three. Ah, but that's part of your foot, not really a toe. Okay, it's a digit. I don't like digit. That's a metatarsal. So number three metatarsal. Okay, because that's actually the bone that's making up your foot. Okay. And don't forget, a digit is a toe or a finger. What kind of bones make up digits? Yeah, phalanges, right? So here I see some phalanges. So these are all phalanges over here. So let's look at this one. This one's easy to name. What phalanx is that? That's number one, but it could be number one this one or number one this one. So this is number one proximal. And then here's number one, distal. And remember, the funny thing about these phalanges is that in the number one digit, there's only two. You only got a proximal or distal. You don't have the middle one. But if we were to look, and maybe I can zoom in, zoom, zoom, zoom. All right. This one right here, so this is number five. Here's the number of five digits. So this is number five, proximal, number five, distal, and number five, middle phalanx. Okay, so Don't forget, the number one has only got two phalanges. All the rest have three, just like your hand. All right, so that's easy to mix those up for some reason. So always think about what's going on there. All right, so that's appendicular skeleton. So think of the girdles, the bones that make up the girdles. You know what the function of the girdles are? Then all the pieces of those two different limbs. Okay. So that's that. Now, so who's got some questions regarding maybe the practicum or something like that? I suppose we could review a little bit. I don't have any models right here, right, which is going to be the important thing for a practicum, because it's not going to be on pictures. It's going to be on those bones. The actual bones or models, yeah.
So we won't, I know you mentioned a lot of ligaments that attach to it, but we won't need to know that for the practicum.
You won't need to know that for the practicum. I think in what we'll do in lab after the practicum is to look at some joints, and in joints we'll have to know some ligaments. So that's why I mention it right now, so that you're just a little bit familiar with it when we start talking about joints. So ligaments are going to be real important when we get to the knee, which will be like the next thing. But that won't be on this practicum, that will be on the next practicum, the knee joint. And that's a really good joint to know about. A lot of unfortunate pathology with knees. And it's not too complicated compared to like a shoulder or something like that. All right, so the way that the practicum will be set up, there'll be a bone on the table. And I might, 25 different stations, so maybe 25 different bones. It could be a skull, or it could be a disarticulated bone from the skull. And when you walk up to a station, what's the first thing you should do? Okay, check your number, make sure you're going to write your answer down. But don't look at the specimen. I would read the question first, because that will get you focused right in on how to answer the question properly. Because you might see a humerus, and so your first thought would be to write what down? Humerus, but maybe it's pointing to some kind of, let's try this. How about the lateral condylar distal surface of a humerus? What's going to be lateral? That's going to be the outside. So that's going to articulate what bone in the forearm? The radius. And the radius articulates with what condylar surface on the humerus? That's going to be the capitulum. Yeah, and it's the trochlea, because the ulna has that big notch, and it's a trochlear notch, right? So read the question, and then you can zoom right into that area and not get kind of sidetracked. Right, so some of the questions might be, name the bone. Other questions might say, well, what's this feature of the bone, whether it's a foramen or a process or notch or whatever. So I would read the question first. That's probably the easiest way of doing it. Okay, and then we'll spend a minute or minute and a half or whatever, time people sort of need, and then move to the next station, and then we'll be done with practicum number two. All right, what about the online material? What kind of sections in that online material are people finding most helpful? You know, there's a lot of stuff there. There's Get Body Smart, there's Essential Study Partners, and there's the online quiz. Well, online quizzes are helpful, I think, because that helps you get ready for the quiz, the online quiz. But what are the other sections that are really helpful?
The
pictures?
That you move over,
Yeah. That's, the labeling exercises, okay? Now, in Essential Study Partner, there are labeling exercises. They're not as big, and you have to hunt around for them. They're usually a couple layers deep. Okay. So if you want to do some snooping around in there, you could give those a try. It's just the same kind of pictures, just a little bit different angle or orientation that might help develop your eye. And then there were a couple other sections that I put in from different websites where, again, there's like drag and drop exercises, and some of those are really nice illustrations, or might even be pictures of the bones. So you might want to look, or maybe I could demonstrate that to you. But what else would be really good to go over right now? You want to look over some skull bones?
Cool.
Yeah. Let's look over some skull bones. I think I probably should have something on here regarding skull bones. Histology flash quiz. Oh, you mean I don't have skull bone flash quiz in here? Holy moly. Is that true? Okay. A lot of interesting stuff. These aren't from my classes. I don't have I think I have it on my thumb drive. I can load it up. Okay, maybe I'll try that. Because I just have the video online. That's not as good. Chemistry flash quiz. How about a chemistry flash quiz? Got that?
Yeah, I'm done with that.
That's for physiology, actually. So, what does that mean? It's probably good that you guys take a chemistry class before physiology, okay? Oh, I like this. Oh, let me copy it. Okay, so bone number one,
hyoid
bone. All right, kind of looks like a mandible. Could be maybe a fetal mandible, but I don't see. How do I know this is not a fetal mandible? Because there are no sockets where the teeth go. What do we call those sockets? This is really the reason why I'm asking you this. Alveoli, right? The little sockets. We don't call them a fossa or a fovea. We call them an alveolus, right? I don't see any alveoli right here, so that's got to be a mandible. I mean a hyoid bone, sorry. Okay, next one. It's kind of like a blade. It's a long, flat one. Makes the inferior part of the nasal septum. That's a vomer. It's missing a little piece, but that's as close to a vomer as we can get. Okay. Maxilla, upper jawbone. So an alveolus would be right in here, but the tooth is inserted into it. Here's an alveolar process. This is the alveolar margin. All right. And here is a part of the maxilla that's reaching up and touching the frontal bone. So you would name this the frontal process. Right. I don't know if you have to know that or not, but it's good to know a little nomenclature. This process right here is touching the zygomatic bone, so this is what we call the zygomatic process of the maxilla. The maxilla is pretty interesting because most of the interior spaces of the maxilla are empty. There's a big cavity right there. Does anybody know what that cavity is called? That's the maxillary paranasal sinus. Yeah, I would take nasal sinus, that's fine. And then I see a little hole right here. What's that? Infraorbital foramen, right? Because this forms the inferior margin of the orbital cavity. And then this would be what we call the orbital plate of the maxilla. All right? I don't know if you have to know all that or not, but I'm just kind of describing this maxilla for you. Oh, wrong way. All right, and then we've got tiny, tiny little bone right in this area right here. You're going to have a nostril. So this is a nasal bone that forms a bridge of your nose, right? And you got two of these. You don't have to know any pieces of the nasal bones. Oh, sorry. Really funny one. This is inside your nasal cavity. It's a standalone bone all by itself. It air conditions the air as we breathe in. That's the nasal concha, and in particular, inferior nasal concha. I don't know if I'd put that on a practicum or not. But. Okay. Another one. Very prominent bone, but it's kind of dinky. What is that? Zygomatic bone. Yeah, zygomatic bone. And palatine bone. This makes the lateral wall of the nasal cavity, and then this makes the posterior part of the hard palate or roof of your mouth. All right, so this would be the perpendicular plate, this would be the horizontal plate, yeah.
Are you going to have these ones out on a practicum?
I suppose there's a possibility. I don't know, I haven't put that test together yet.
Could you see those ones?
Yeah. Yeah. You don't think?
That one we did, but some of the other, the nasal bone or the vomer by himself, we didn't see those.
Vomer probably not. Yeah. Or the nasal concha, not the nasal concha. Yeah. So what individual bones could you recognize pretty easily? Sphenoid. Maxilla. Okay, hopefully, you know, I picked something pretty obvious for you guys. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Here,
okay. This tall one right here, this is the vertical plate. And then the small one right here, that's the horizontal plate. So the palatine bones, the way they fit in your head, if they're L's, right, but they're backward, they're a mirror image, they kind of fit like this. All right, so the horizontal plates make the roof of your mouth, and the vertical plates make the wall of your nasal cavity. Okay. And that's the ethmoid. Okay, so here I see the crista galli cribriform plate with all these little olfactory foramina in it. And also there are a bunch of holes in the ethmoid bone. So the ethmoid bone, just like the maxilla, has paranasal sinuses, right? But we would call those the ethmoid paranasal sinuses. What other two bones have paranasal sinuses besides the, what did we talk about, maxilla and ethmoid? Two more. Sphenoid and the frontal bone up over here have paranasal sinuses. Okay. You got some pretty good pictures in your book with that. Little dinky lacrimal bone. Okay, can you point to where that is? Right in here, don't poke too hard because it could break. And occipital bone, foramen magnum, occipital condyles, all right, and what kind of surface is a condyle? Rough or smooth? It's really smooth. It's an articular surface, right, for the atlas, C1. And we got a mandible. Okay, so here's the body, here's the angle, here's the ramus, here's a condylar process with condylar surface. Oh, what's this one? Coronoid process, okay? And here's a little mental foramen right here, and then there's another one back over here. That's the mandibular foramen, okay? Temporal bone. What's this right here? External auditory meatus, and let's see if I can, okay. So this is, come on, cursor, this is the anterior side, because this is reaching up, touching the zygomatic bone, so that's a zygomatic process of the temporal bone. So then back behind the ear, right here, this is the mastoid process. And then there should be a nice bone that's sticking down here. That's a styloid process. And then this is the squamous region of the temporal bone and the external auditory meatus. I forgot if we said that or not. Okay. Here's a pretty nondescript cranial bone. Parietal bone. Doesn't really have much in the way of features to it. And, coming right at you, sphenoid bone. Okay, greater wing, lesser wing, optic canal. This is the body. I don't know if you have to know that. Oh, but these processes down here, the pterygoid processes, What's the function of these pterygoid processes? Muscle attachment. And the names of those muscles are the pterygoids. Okay, so that's one nice thing about knowing bones pretty well. It helps you know a lot of stuff.
Frontal bone.
Frontal bone. Okay, so here is the orbital plate of the frontal bone. This is the orbital margin, and this would be the supraoptic or orbital, supraorbital foramen or notch, depending on whether it's a notch or a foramen. The glabella is this bump right here. And what's deep to the bone right in here? Yeah, sinuses, paranasal sinuses, right, and the frontal bone. And there's also going to be a sinus within the sphenoid bone right in this region right here. Okay. So I think that's pretty much it. But you want to go through it real fast? One more time. Parietal. Temporal. Mandible. Occipital. That's a lacrimal. Lacrimal, tiny, tiny lacrimal bone. Ethmoid. Too much coffee. Ah. That was palatine bone. And then this one was the zygomatic. That's a nasal conchae. Inferior nasal conchae. Nasal bone. Maxilla. Oh, that's the vomer, inferior nasal bone of the nasal septum. Hyoid bone. Frontal. Sphenoid. Yeah, so you guys might get really bored on this practicum. I'm not sure, but...
No?
Okay, we'll just take it one step at a time. Parietal. Okay, so that's it for today. And I don't have a sheet, so you guys can just take off. Oh, a quiz. You know, I don't like to give a quiz on days that you have a practicum as well. Oh, a quiz. Oh, the online quiz? Yeah.
Still do?
Yeah. Isn't it? I think it's there.
Yeah, it is.
It's there. Yep. So, like clockwork. Online quiz. Online quiz. Like clockwork. Okay. Fantastic. How did you do? All right. That's good. It's possible. It's possible.
Yeah, like last week.
It was not possible last week. Yeah.
I'm the one that always emails you.
Okay.
Okay, C7.
The
how do you say it? Vertebral prominence.
Vertebral prominence. Vertebral prominence. Yeah, it's right there. You got it right there. It just kind of, everybody's got that little hump right there.
Yeah. All right. What else?
What part of C7 is that?
What part?
Yeah, what part is that?
What do you mean? The name?
Yeah. What are the parts of a general vertebrae?
Are you quizzing me right now?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you got the body.
Yeah, the body.
But what part is that? Would that be the body?
Oh, this? It's sticking out?
Yeah.
No?
I agree, it's not. What part of a vertebrae would you call that? What part sticks straight posterior? You got it. Spinous process.
I know, my spiny process. Never
yeah,
do that.
Spinous process.
Is there a way to check out, like, bones? Like, check out...
There's some in the library, but there has to be a tutor there. Yeah.
A tutor?
Yeah, because they're locked up in the tutoring room. And the tutor might be there right now, for all I know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So we could just...
just go over there and see if there's an anatomy tutor available.
What are they,
first floor or second floor?
First floor.
First floor?
Yeah. If you walk in, it's going to be on the right somewhere. But you could maybe ask somebody at the counter right at the front.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you show us that? The inferior orbital fissure on the sphenoid?
Only on a complete skull can you see it.
Oh, okay.
But on a sphenoid by itself, disarticulated, you can only see the inferior orbital fissure, but not the superior.
Okay.
So if I were going to ask you superior or inferior, it would be on the skull so you could tell which one's on top of the other one.
Okay. Okay, I've been writing all this stuff out.
Cool. That helps with spelling. Indeed.
Hopefully, I'll do this.
I hope so too. Indeed. See you. Thank you.